Islamophobia and Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise since President Trump was elected in 2016, reaching higher numbers than during the immediate aftermath of September 11th. Throughout his time in politics, the president has only fueled these divisive flames.
I think Islam hates us. There's something there that there's a tremendous hatred there. There's a tremendous hatred. We have to get to the bottom of it.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Umar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Since Trump's election, the number of Muslim candidates running for office has also risen, with at least 90 Muslim candidates running for positions in the 2018 midterm election, up from just a dozen in 2016. Last week, the Muslim Caucus held a conference they called the Muslim Collective for Equitable Democracy in Washington, D.C. The conference was billed as the first national gathering of Muslim politicians, and among the attendees was Representative Ilhan Omar.
We forget that this system of oppression that continues to build and continues to other so many of us and vilify us in the process to almost eliminate our existence in many aspects of society. And so I think, at least for me, it's not that I'm going to allow it to distract me, but I'm interested in unmasking it and taking it to task.
But just three presidential candidates spoke at the conference. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio was the only candidate who came in person. Senator Elizabeth Warren and Washington Governor Jay Inslee joined by live stream. Many of the caucus's organizers expressed discontent that their reliably Democratic voting members are being overlooked by the party and taken for granted. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Joining me now is the founder and president of the Muslim Caucus, Ghazala Salam, and Arsalan Iftikhar, a human rights lawyer and senior research fellow for the Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University, a research project on Islamophobia. Ghazala and Arsalan, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having us, Tanzina.
Thank you.
Arsalan, let's start with you. We just mentioned the rise in Islamophobia in the last couple of years in the United States. How has that manifested?
Well, Tanzina, I think for the first time in American history, you had an American president who said that there should be a total and complete shutdown of all Muslims entering the United States. I think that had he said this about any other minority demographic group today, he probably wouldn't have gotten away with it. And I think that it's important to keep in mind that this is just a small microcosm of his long history of Islamophobia. He once famously told CNN's Anderson Cooper that, quote, "I think Islam hates us. He's called for the surveillance of mosques. He started the Barack Obama birther controversy about President Barack Obama being some sort of crypto-Muslim. And, he surrounded himself with people in the White House like Steve Bannon, Sebastian Gorka, Stephen Miller, all who've made Islamophobic statements." And so, sadly, Islamophobia has now become part and parcel of the Republican Party ideology today.
And is the Islamophobia that we're witnessing today different than the rise of Islamophobia in the aftermath of 9/11?
Yes, for the sole reason of the fact that the commander-in-chief is, making Islamophobic statements. You know, both with George W. Bush and Barack Obama, they went out of their way to let the American people know, to let the global public know that that we were not at war with Muslims or Islam. And Donald Trump has literally laid that to the wayside. And I think as we move towards the 2020 election, for Muslims, at least in the United States, we have to serve as intersectional allies to other minorities who have been disenfranchised by Donald Trump's presidency.
Ghazala, can you tell us a little bit about the conference that happened a couple days ago? What were your goals in what were you hoping to accomplish, and what would have made the conference a success?
First, I think the conference was very successful. Our goal was to bring together American Muslims, activists, organizers, policymakers, candidates, elected officials, community leaders in a space that was safe to discuss issues that impact our communities, not just the American Muslim community, but the American communities at large. And I think we were very successful in doing that. We wanted to make sure that the politicians and the media were aware of the diversity in our community, because I think when people tend to believe the stereotypes, they tend to think that our community is a monolithic. We only are one issue-based community. So we wanted to make sure that the diversity of the American Muslim community who is here in this nation, who are, you know, who've been here from the very beginning of this nation, who are a fabric of this nation. African Americans make up a third of the American Muslim community. And so we come from 90 different nations, ethnicities. We just wanted to make sure that the awareness was there that we are diverse, our issues are diverse, and we're not a monolithic. We don't all speak the same way or vote the same way. And I think we were successful in getting across that message.
Tell me a little bit about the reaction as you were preparing this organization. Was there any pushback in advance?
I think, you know, there were pushbacks from some organizations. You know, people could not see the vision of why such a conference was needed. People were thinking, well, this sort of work is already being done. Lots of organizations are doing great work across the country. But our vision was to, you know, create a national infrastructure for American Muslims to organize and win at very grassroots levels because, you know, politics is local, as we all know, and we want to make sure that we're building our capacity, resources, and leadership, not just within the American Muslim communities, but as Arsalan just mentioned, the other communities who are being, you know, who've been inflicted by being othered by this administration. We want to make sure we're building our collective power as American Muslims.
And as we know, of course, well, we can't not ignore the fact that there is a critical election coming up in 2020. There were three presidential candidates, all Democrats, who spoke, who at least were at the conference. De Blasio was there in person. Inslee and Warren, as we mentioned, did so via video. What are Muslim voters looking for in 2020? And was the response from the Democratic candidates sufficient in your opinion, Ghazala?
I think the response could have been deeper. You know, there are more discussions need to happen on issues that impact the American Muslim community. Islamophobia needs to be addressed, and conversations need to be had at every level of administration. So whoever the next president is, you know, not only will they, I think, automatically have to repeal the Muslim ban, but also look at other policies that are impacting communities just because of their race and their religion has to be looked at very deeper in a deep way. And making sure that their cabinets, you know, are reflective of members of our society. I think a lot of times people are hesitant to vote because they don't see themselves on the ballot. And we need to make sure that whoever is elected as the next president is actually representative of all constituents in the United States.
Arsalan, I'm curious your thoughts on that. What policy initiatives or otherwise are Muslim voters going to be looking for in 2020? And as we mentioned at the top, this is a group of voters that tend to swing Democratic. Do you think this community has been sort of taken for granted by the Democratic Party?
Well, the short answer is yes, and the long answer is yes. I think that when you look at, you know, any historically marginalized minorities in American society today, especially in the from the latter part of the 20th century onwards, you know, they have traditionally politically aligned themselves with the Democratic Party, whether it's African Americans or Latinos or women in general. And so obviously Muslim Americans, since we've, you know, caught the disparate brunt of the post 9/11 backlash, so too do we now overwhelmingly vote Democratic. I think what's interesting for me, at least, is that, you know, I'm not that as concerned that whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee, you know, won't overturn the Muslim ban and things like that. But there is a lot of harm and damage that has been done by Donald Trump during his administration, whether it's, you know, the Paris Climate Accord or, you know, turning back other, you know, Obama initiatives. And so, you know, this is, again, it's going to be an all hands on deck approach, you know, when it comes to mobilizing, ensuring that, you know, it's not only enough that we show this sort of you know, righteous indignation against Donald Trump on social media. But when it comes to Election Day 2020, that we actually get out and vote, particularly in the battleground states of, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Florida, and making sure that, you know, our ground game, so to speak, politically for minorities and people of color in the United States, when it comes to getting out to vote, getting people registered to vote before 2020, I think the ground game is going to be the thing that is going to decide who wins the next election.
And we mentioned also that there have been an increase in hate crimes against Muslims in this country. What do you expect, if any, the response to that to be from either the FBI, the Department of Justice, local police departments?
Or Donald Trump, which has been nothing. You know, a couple years back, there was a brutal murder in Portland, Oregon, on a public city bus where two Good Samaritans were murdered by a white supremacist just because these two Good Samaritans were trying to protect a young Muslim woman and her friend who were at the receiving end of Islamophobic statements. A couple of years ago, we had three young Muslim college students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, who were shot point blank in the head, execution style, in their own apartment by a neighbor named Craig Hicks, who had frequently posted anti-Muslim diatribes on Facebook. Earlier this year, we saw in Christchurch, New Zealand, where there was a mosque massacre where 50 people were brutally murdered by another white supremacist. We saw that happen in Quebec City, Quebec, a few years ago. And so we're not only seeing, you know, the rhetoric of Islamophobia, we're now seeing Islamophobia weaponized to the point where you're seeing Islamophobic hate crimes, similar to the anti-Semitic hate crimes that we saw at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh or in Poway, California. And so it's really not only important enough to condemn xenophobia, but understand that it can then become weaponized by white supremacists, which is what it has, and it leads to the death of innocent people.
Ghazala, last thoughts on that point from you. I mean, with the rise of hate crimes and Islamophobia, what type of response do you expect to see? We've got a little under a minute left.
So I think that other countries are being emboldened by seeing the lack of attention given to the Islamophobia in this country and all the hate mongering and othering of communities coming from the top level office of this administration is emboldening countries like China in their treatment with the Uyghur Muslim community, Burma, India with the lynching of Muslims, Saudi Arabia with everything that they're doing. So we have to first look at our own country and see how we are holding ourselves accountable when it comes to justice and equity for all, and then be able to hold and call out these other countries for their human rights violations and injustices towards minority communities.
Ghazala Salam is the founder and president of the Muslim Caucus, and Arsalan Iftikhar is a lawyer and fellow at Georgetown University. Ghazala and Arsalan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.